Hey then, welcome to Making Positive Psychology Work, the weekly podcast where we uncover tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work so together we can better navigate the incredible challenges and opportunities our world faces. I'm your host, Michelle McQuaid, and what you probably don't know about me is that as a young child, I once rode a runaway camel around a showground, much to my mother's horror, and to be honest, as she ran after it screaming, I don't think the camel was that delighted either. Thank you so much for joining me for lesson number 30 of Making Positive Psychology Work. I'm so glad you're here because today we're talking to Kathleen Cator, who has trained with many of the pioneers of mindfulness and compassion, including Jon Kabat-Zinn, Paul Gilbert, Kristen Neff, and Chris Germer. A clinical psychologist and former nurse, Kathleen has over 20 years of experience as a health professional who leads self-compassion and mindfulness-based training and therapies in public education and healthcare settings. But what you probably don't know about Kathleen is that she grew up on a family farm in Australia and spent 4 months on horseback droving cattle when she was just 11 years old. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thanks, Michelle. It's great to be here.
I'm so looking forward to this conversation, Kathleen, because it seems everywhere I turn at the moment, from Oprah to school teachers, people are talking about self-compassion. So let's start by just getting clear. What exactly is self-compassion?
So I think to think about self-compassion, it's helpful to think about compassion for another because we're probably more familiar with that idea. So if you think about a time where you felt compassionate, say, to a colleague who or a friend that you really care about, we feel compassion because we notice that they're struggling or they're having a difficult time. And then, you know, sometimes I don't even have to say anything, but we pay attention to them. And then we feel kind and caring towards them. We give them time and we listen to them. We often will speak to them in a really sort of gentle tone. And then because we feel compassion, we're motivated to do what we can to help them.
So how does being mindful to someone suffering, being able to connect with those very human experiences we're all having and showing kindness in these moments, how could we use those skills towards ourselves when it comes to self-compassion?
So the compassion inwards is treating yourself as if you were a good friend during times of difficulty or when you've made a mistake. But unfortunately, what we do know is that people don't respond to themselves in this way. We often ignore how we're feeling or pretend that we're not feeling like that. We'll be telling ourselves, just get on with it or suck it up. This is why self-compassion is such an important practice.
Kathleen, what are the benefits researchers are finding around the practice of self-compassion?
If we're caught up in what the opposite of self-compassion is harsh self-criticism, we are in a state of fight, flight and freeze and we're in a threatened state. And so we all know how we feel when the harsh self-critic is talking to us, when we say to ourselves, if you're fat or you're lazy, and we're not as productive. We're not able to be attuned to others. We tend to close ourselves off and we experience a lot of stress and anxiety and worry. We often become self-centered and self-absorbed in our problems because we're unable to see things clearly. So the ramifications of being caught up with self-criticism, which is the opposite of self-compassion, are clear. The research is very compelling. Kristen Neff, who's the researcher, the pioneer researcher in the area of self-compassion, has got hundreds of articles with her colleagues that demonstrate that self-compassion has a positive effect on your well-being emotionally and physically. It's good for your relationships. It helps people adopt healthy habits and make positive changes. It makes you more able to learn from your mistakes and to reach out for help. There's just hundreds of studies now that have been generated to show the benefits of self-compassion.
I think there's two really important themes that you were picking up there that I'd love to dive in a bit more. And the first is back actually into that space of self-criticism, because I know neuroscientists are finding, just as you're touching on, that self-criticism actually shifts our brain into a state of self-inhibition and self-punishment that can actually cause us to disengage from our goals. And yet I know for many people in the organisations that I work, and particularly leaders, often very type A, high-driven, achieving kind of people, they really attribute a lot of their success to that self-criticism, that inner critic really driving them forward out of fear. But of course, it comes with such anxiety. So is inner criticism, that inner critic, is that ever a healthy thing for us? Or should we always be trying to move from that inner critic into a state of self-compassion, do you think?
This is a great question. And I think this is one of the problems about self-compassion, because people have a fear that if they're self-compassionate, they'll let themselves off the hook. So when we talk about the self-critic, we don't talk about discernment. This is when it's an overly or a harsh self-critic. And so there's also other barriers to self-compassion, which often people think about, that I'll be selfish if I'm self-compassionate, or I'm weak, or it's self-indulgent. And these are what psychologists like myself call core beliefs, which have developed out of our learning histories of when we're in our families, our societies. But we do know, like we intuitively know, that if you can encourage yourself with kindness and motivation and wise counsel, you're going to be better at your job and be able to perform better.
I think that's so true. And yet again, I know the habit for many of us is to reach straight for that inner critic. And as you're saying, you know, whether we're so fat or we're so lazy or just not good enough, or we're always letting people down. And I think for many of us, those voices have become so habitual that it can be hard to move them out. And there is that fear about, will I still be as motivated without them? For me, I know, having relied on that inner critic for many years in my own life, one of the things that helped me at least experiment more with self-compassion was that understanding again that neurologically what self-compassion did was help to activate my brain's caregiving and its self-awareness system. And that did seem to make it easier for me to believe that I was capable and worthy. Yeah, I made mistakes sometimes and I get things wrong, but at heart, you know, I'm a good person. I'm generally trying my best and I can learn as I go. I can always get better at something, which I know definitely made me less self-conscious. I was less likely to compare myself to others, and if I was keeping up with them, and just a bit less generally insecure, so that inner critic didn't need to come up quite so much. Now, is this just a Michelle McQuaid experience, or is this something you see in other people as you're teaching the skills of self-compassion as well?
Well, it sounds like you are really working, and this is what we call the practice of self-compassion, is working with language and using kind words, because they're going to help calm down your stress and your physiological system. We know that that's effective. Often when we first start talking about self-compassion, we look at the way our brains have evolved. And unfortunately, our brains have evolved to keep us safe but not happy. Our brains are threat-focused. I'm sure you've heard the work of Rick Hansen. He says that we have Teflon for positive experiences but Velcro for negative experiences. So we need to have an understanding of this is the way our brains are wired. And then that's why mindfulness is really important, to allow us to stop and pause and take notice of what we're experiencing and then choose another way of responding.
So I know the research on self-compassion suggests that we practice being mindful of how we're feeling, to remember that we're all connected and all learning, and to talk to ourselves like a wise and kind friend or mentor might. So how do you teach people to practice these skills effectively?
One of the ways we can do this is based on a practice called self-compassion break that uses the three components. And first of all, it's mindfulness. First of all, slowing down and noticing how am I feeling. So if the self-critic is running the show, noticing the stress and the contraction or any discomfort that's arising in your body, and just recognizing that this is difficult, this is stress. Some people might just like to say, ouch. And then the second part, as you mentioned, is the common humanity. And this is a really important piece, because this allows us to remember that we're not alone in our experience. We're just human beings. So if we can accept and tolerate the fact that we're not perfect, we'll be less judgmental of ourselves and more understanding. So that we can say to ourselves, we're not alone, and there's nothing wrong with me for feeling like this. All people feel like this. And then the third part is remembering to be kind to yourself. And like you were saying, you know, just reminding yourself that you're doing your best. And sometimes this actually being using language of kindness to yourself, people get in a stumbling block. So you might like to then bring to mind someone you really care about. And we find that people are more spontaneous and able to say things more naturally to someone that they care about. And then we just tuck ourselves in with these words. It might be, I'm here for you, or, you know, may I be kind to myself when I'm having a difficult time or when I've made a mistake.
I love those practices. And I know you've trained with Kristen Neff and her team, and you run some amazing self-compassion programs here in Australia for people to learn these skills. What are some of the other practices of self-compassion you find it helpful for people to have, particularly perhaps in a workplace setting where it's not always easy to slow down in the middle of a meeting when everything's coming at you and that inner critic's firing up, or those situations where we can't always easily remove ourselves from them? Are there other things that you find in the self-compassion toolkit are helpful for people?
Yes, well, I mean, I think like any toolkit or skill, it is good to learn them when you've got time to put it into practice and to be okay with being a slow learner. The one that I think is that people really resonate is the soothing touch, and that's using a gesture of self-compassion. And we get people to experiment with the sense of touch and what feels reassuring for them. Now, obviously, in a meeting, you probably are not going to have your hands on your heart, but sometimes just holding your hand can bring a sense of reassurance and calm yourself down. And likewise, using the breath, that is an anchor that we can use anywhere and any time. And so if we have a practice of mindful breathing and calming and soothing, using the breath to soothe ourselves, just taking three breaths can be radical. It's just a reset button.
I think it's a reset button most of us don't use enough. And I know one of the ways you taught me about self-touch, actually, when we were both doing talks together on a stage in front of a lot of people, was just that very subtle putting one hand over the other wrist, the opposite wrist, and just kind of gently holding your wrist and breathing slowly as you did that as a form of self-compassionate touch that I find actually really easy to use in any public place without anybody knowing that that's a form of touch that I can rely on. What else might people try if they're wanting to improve their practice of self-compassion and they're perhaps not yet used to using that kind of voice on themselves?
I think there's many aspects of being able to be compassionate, and sometimes it's simple as just grounding and achieving a sense of calmness, and that can be just by taking notice of your environment and engaging in your senses, whether it be the sense of sight or smell or touch or taste. So just tuning into your senses will bring you back to the present moment. There's so many exercises and practices, and there's over 25 practices that we teach in our 8-week program. So what we find is that people like to try them on and then find what works best for them. Some people really like journaling and writing to themselves and writing from the stance of a compassionate self, and just mindful movement, just standing up and stretching in a mindful way, can just bringing your awareness and care back to the physical body. Is the body can be a great way of checking in and being present.
Kathleen, some of these self-compassion practices like mindful movement sound really similar to mindfulness practices in general. And I know you studied with Jon Kabat-Zinn and that Kristen and her colleagues have been conducting studies comparing mindfulness-based stress reduction training with self-compassion training. Is there any real difference between the two, or is self-compassion just mindfulness repackaged?
Well, I started with the MBSR course with Jon Kabat-Zinn. And however, for me, the task of bringing your attention back to the present moment in a non-judgmental way was very challenging, very difficult. And I just found myself being more aware of my tendency to ruminate. And so the self-compassion aspect has a more active component, because I think it's an antidote to this self-critical mind, and it's a way of working more skillfully with those cognitions and those emotions that arise during our practice. Mindfulness is essential in self-compassion. You can't have self-compassion without mindfulness. But I see that self-compassion just brings a way of warmth, the tenderness, the sensitivity to yourself and to yourself as an experiencer. So I think the mindfulness programs that a lot of people do may be focused on bringing concentration. The qualities of compassion and kindness are inherent in the mindfulness courses, but self-compassion teaches this far more explicitly.
I'm smiling as you're describing that difference, because I think many of us have had that experience with mindfulness meditation of our monkey minds getting the best of us and then beating ourselves up in the process. So I can completely understand the value that self-compassion would add to that practice. So Kathleen, what can we do to support self-compassion practices in others? If we're a leader in a workplace and we can see one of our team members really struggling with their inner critic and it's undermining their well-being and performance, how can we introduce self-compassionate practices to our teams?
This is a very good question, and I think we need to have work cultures that encourage people to be open and authentic about their emotional experiences. But unfortunately, I think there's a lot of fear and stigma about mental health issues that prevail, so people don't feel safe to show their feelings. I think as leaders, if you can role model vulnerability, being able to talk about your feelings and also talking about your own mistakes, I think that gives people confidence that they're not going to be shamed or embarrassed or judged for making mistakes. I'm sure you've probably heard the latest from Google. After 4 years of study, they've looked at hundreds of groups and teams, and they found that there is no such thing as a perfect team, but it's the people being kind to each other which makes a difference. And this is talking about creating psychological safety. And I think this is just foremost for all organisations. And I think women leaders are leading the way in this, but I think we've got a long way to go in organisations.
So given self-compassion in a workplace perhaps isn't quite as attractive or comfortable for leaders to sell into their teams as practices like grit, how do you think we can get leaders more on board with encouraging self-compassionate practices? Because I think the research and evidence is absolutely suggesting the benefits. And as you're describing, the studies in Google are finding that this is perhaps the way of the future. But how do we make self-compassion more palatable in organisations, do you think?
Well, from my experience, people really need to feel safe and connected with the group in order to learn these practices. It's not something that you can do quickly, and we need to allow enough time for people to learn and practice. So I think, unfortunately, at the moment, the most effective way to learn self-compassion is in small groups for that safety reason. And I think there needs to be enough time dedicated to learn these practices. This may be a challenge of getting into workplaces, but I hope that the research will be compelling when people see the results that arise from the effectiveness of it. I've found that I have champions working in organisations. They come and do the courses for themselves, and then they're now wanting to introduce them to organisations. But we're really this is at the very early beginnings for self-compassion in organisations.
I agree. And I think understanding that self-compassion isn't a quick fix, but something that takes time and space for people to really explore and feel safe with is a really important aspect of how this practice is introduced into workplaces. Kathleen, are you ready for the lightning round?
Yes, please. Yeah.
So if we take self-compassion as a given, what's the most useful mindfulness or well-being tool of practice or learning that you've applied in your own life and why?
I would say gratitude. I just use gratitude every day for simple things, and I like to remember the people that are associated with those things in life. So it allows me to feel this sense of interconnection with other people as well.
Beautiful. Do you keep a gratitude journal or have a particular practice around gratitude, or how do you make it work for you?
No, I don't have a journal. I use Instagram to post things, you know, for moments of beauty.
Beautiful. What would you recommend as a must-read book for people wanting to bring out the best in themselves and others in workplaces, and why?
Well, I thought this was a great question, and I looked at my hundreds of books on my bookshelf, and I thought there is no definitive one. And I would say that where I'm at the moment is I really want people to start to trust their own wisdom. So I would like them to start a reflective writing practice from the stance of a compassionate, wise mentor. And there's an exercise that I can send you a link for that.
That would be beautiful. We'll put that in the show notes. And I agree. I think the research and the books are fantastic tools to inspire us. But I think we could all do well being more intelligent and active participants in our own well-being rather than thinking somebody else is going to sort it out for us. Kathleen, what are you reading right now, and are you enjoying it?
I'm reading the most wonderful book. It's called The Museum of Love. It's about Marina Abramović. And it's a performance artist, and her performance art is all about love and connection. It's beautiful.
It sounds beautiful. I'm going to go and check that one out. And if there's one thing you wished everybody thought about when it comes to improving compassion or well-being in workplaces, what would it be?
Well, I'm going to quote Henry James, who said there are three things. First, to be kind. Second, to be kind. And the third, to be kind.
Sounds like very good advice. Kathleen, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks, Michelle. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you for listening. For more information on Kathleen's wonderful work, head on over to metahp.com.au and be sure to use her wonderful guided meditations on self-compassion. You've been listening to Making Positive Psychology Work with Michelle McQuaid. For the notes from today's show and more tested practical ways to help people move from functioning to flourishing at work, be sure to head on over to michellemcquaid.com. And if you'd like to perform a random act of kindness today, then share this podcast with a friend or colleague to help improve our workplaces. After all, as Charlie Chaplin wisely said, You'll never find a rainbow if you're looking down. Until next time, take care.